David Crean,
Yes, here.
Tim Morton,
Present.
Eric,
Present.
or further. Okay. I'd like to introduce General Counsel Paul Minnie from Young Minnie and Core. He will be conducting our workshop today. First of all, we'd like to establish the quorum. Do I have a motion for approval of the item 1.3?
Motion to approve.
Motion, second?
Second, more.
Tim, second. Okay. We'll conduct all the voting via roll call. Scott Barton, oh, sorry, Scott Barton's excused. David Crean.
Here.
We're approving the.
Yes, A, sorry.
Tim Martin.
Aye.
Tim Eric.
Aye.
Could we stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please? I pledge allegiance to the
To the
flag
flag
of
of
the
the
United
United States of America and
and
to
to
the
the
Republic
Republic for
which
which
it
it
stands,
stands, one nation
under
under
God,
God,
indivisible,
indivisible,
with
with
liberty
liberty
and justice for
for
all.
all. Thank you. Item 1.5, approval of the agenda. Do I have a motion for approval of 1.5?
Motion
I
to
move.
approve.
A
So move.
motion by David, I think. Second?
Second, Morton.
Tim. Okay, we'll conduct the voting via roll call. David Crean?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Public comment for items of interest to the public and within the scope of Altus School San Diego non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for agenda items shall be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. In meetings held over Zoom, any person who wishes to make a comment on either non-agenda or agenda items shall use the raise hand feature of Zoom to notify the board. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond or give direction to staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, the board chair may decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. Item 2.1, non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 2 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes, unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? None heard. Let's go on to 2.2, agenda public comment. Did I do this? No. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on less than on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on agenda items? None heard. Moving on. 3.0, Part 2, Board Workshop Training. Young Minnie and Core Law Firm will provide comprehensive professional development training to the board on best practices in charter school board management, including fiduciary duties and fiscal oversight, the Brown Act, conflict of interest, and critical case updates and new laws affecting charter schools. Paul Minnie, principal of Young Minnie and Core, will be conducting part two of the board workshop training. So,
Good.
hand this off to Paul.
Good morning, Mary. Good morning, board members and everybody else working at the schools and resource centers today. Appreciate your time. I'm Paul Minnie. I'll actually be splitting the presentation with my colleague, Kayla Haidt, who's on the line as well. She'll be doing the new laws and cases portion of this. But I did want to just do a quick follow-up from the last training where we covered Brown Act and conflict of interest. And actually, I think we had a perfect example here today with Scott Barton, who I understand is maybe at least he might be participating, but as a member of the public, and I'll explain in a moment. But I know the new laws around telephonic or telephony or video or telephone participation in board meetings are confusing. You can thank the legislature for that. They were trying to create exceptions to allow greater access to meetings for members of the public. But in doing so, they really created a jumbled mess of the government code around the Brown Act. But one provision in the law, which predated the pandemic, still exists. And that's the standard telephonic participation requirements. If you do like you're doing today, if you hold a meeting via Zoom, you post the fact that you're holding it via Zoom, you post the location of each board member's location via Zoom, as you have done. If you post the agenda at those locations as per the code, whether it's 72 or 24 hours in advance, if you allow the public to participate from those locations, and if you hold a roll call vote and you have a quorum of your members in San Diego County, you can hold these meetings. You can continue to hold these telephonic meetings in perpetuity. Now, what that does, though, is we understood, for example, that board member Barton was going to be excused, but actually at the last minute was able to possibly join. But because we didn't have time 72 hours in advance of the regular meeting to amend the agenda to include his location, say he was at a, you know, in a hotel room or a conference center or whatever, he could join as a member of the public, but he wouldn't be counted for purposes of the board quorum today. And so I just wanted to reiterate that the law, that flexibility is still left in the law. That is the least complicated and most efficient use of continuing to hold your meetings via telephony. So
if anybody has any questions around that. Scott hasn't joined us yet, but he was going to try while he was in transit. So he'd be actually traveling.
Great. And that's codified in your bylaws as well. So I just wanted to clarify that point before we start in. So let's see, Angela, do I have the ability to screen share? I think I do here. Great. Please let me know that I am in a second sharing the screen, and I'll do the slideshow. Are we up and running?
Yes.
Excellent. Let me just change the location here. Now I'm just looking at Mary. Anyway, everybody, we're going to start in on the slides from last time at the point of roles and responsibilities of the board member and administration. We're going to be talking about best practices and governance strategies. I think, gave you a brief introduction last time. Our firm has been at this for 30 years. In fact, Mary, you'll appreciate this. 30 years ago, this month, probably about this time, I was getting my bar results. And within 2 months, I was actually working with a gentleman named David Girard, and the Charter Schools Act had passed, and I was on a typewriter at El Dorado County Office of Education, typing up the fifth charter in the state of California, which was still operative today. So it's been 30 years. What we've done in 30 years collectively as a firm and as lawyers is we've distilled down the top 10 list of criteria, acumen, things that boards do, excellent boards do, boards that have survived as long as this board, by the way, and as many other boards in the state of California that date back to 1993. It's our legal hindsight, but also in compilation with national studies. Brian Carpenter and others that have put together studies, he studied it for his PhD, the things that charter schools do to fail. So the opposite of some of these things are things that charter schools do to fail, obviously, then help us inform this list. The slides that follow will go into greater detail on some of these, I think the key ones, but generally, this is the top 10 list. So number one, a really excellent board, a really effective and efficient board understands the distinction between its role and responsibilities and the administration's roles and responsibilities. And we'll go into that on the next slide. This board, or a board that's effective, governs, it doesn't manage. And again, we'll go into that in a little detail a little later. The board itself, both in its meetings, outside the meetings, public gatherings, any other places it shows up together or individually, contributes to the positive school culture. So I know attending graduations and being a spokesperson for the school and the corporation, otherwise outside the board meetings, et cetera, is very important to building that positive environment around the school. The board, which this board has always done, by the way, acts as a single unit and speaks with one voice. It understands that the majority of the board controls, and when a majority makes a decision, that is the will of the board. And even if you are in the minority of the decision, you support the majority of the board because you support the concept that this democratic principle is the most effective means of operation for the organization, and that discord and speaking with different voices, as we see very often in our political structure, creates a lot of tension, confusion, and discord. Number five, board members maintain their fiduciary duties, duty of loyalty, duty of care, duty of inquiry, and we'll cover those in the following slides. Very key. So it's your commitment as a board member to keeping as the number one interest something other than yourselves, your interests. You're keeping the interests of the corporation and the schools that that corporation operates as the number one consideration in all decisions. Number six, the board knows how to respond appropriately to complaints. Now, board members that have accessible to members of the public, either via email or otherwise. And if members of the public or staff members or whatnot were to complain directly to the board, board members understand that there are processes in place to make sure that those complaints get captured by administration and worked on and responded to by the administration. A lot of the policies in place hopefully will allow for the resolution of a complaint at the lowest possible level. Then it might get escalated to the middle administration, maybe to Mary's desk. And if it is something that gets unresolved, some complaints elevate their way to the board. But if people can bypass that process by complaining to individual board members, the board members themselves become the complaint center. And this is an ineffective way to manage the operation. So an efficient board understands that they can say, I understand you have a concern, so-and-so, but please direct your concerns to Mary or Tim or Lynn and whoever is the primary recipient of concerns and complaints at the organization for resolution. Board members, excellent board members and boards do regular education, professional development, PD for themselves, attend conferences, go to trainings like this annually, and keep up to date on changes in the law. Absolutely critical. As you will see, every year, the legislature just keeps changing the primary rules and responsibilities of schools, public schools, and charter schools in the state of California. And you need to stay ahead of that and understand both what's happening and where court cases and the like are going. Primary role of the board as it governs and doesn't manage, it monitors the four key areas, I would add. Student performance, number one, because charter schools are all about academic performance. That's the compact that we enter into when we enter into a charter. We get freed from the rules and responsibilities that govern school districts in the law, for the most part, and in exchange for producing academic performance. Second is finances. Absolute maintenance of fiscal solvency of the organization is critical. Number one reason charter schools fail is fiscal malfeasance and insolvency. I would say three, and safety falls into this. It's sort of legal and safety, monitoring the making sure that the organization, the board itself, is following the rules that are applicable to it by law, and monitoring the overall safety of the organization, students, staff, et cetera. Those are the high-level governance issues the board faces. And then the understanding the role and division between the board and the administration, the primary function of the board is to hire and evaluate and maintain accountability over the primary leader of the organization. And then he or she is responsible for, as we'll see, the day-to-day management of the organization. And then lastly, regularly engage the board in strategic planning. What are our long-term and short-term goals, and how are we doing meeting those goals on a regular basis? So that's our top 10 hit list. If anybody, again, please jump in if anybody has any questions as we go through these. Looking back at that first point, understanding that division of responsibility between the board and the management, making sure you govern and you don't manage, it's not always clear. There is some overlap sometimes, especially in the language that we use. But for the most part, you look at this chart, these are just examples that are not parallel to each other. You have to sort of read them in isolation. But the board as we said, hires, evaluates, and disciplines the primary executive leader here, the CEO. Then that school leader is responsible for hiring and supervising management, mid-management, you know, teachers, staff, everybody else. Then the board is responsible for monitoring and implementing the policies of the school, approving the school's annual budget and budget revisions, again, at a high level, contracting with an external auditor, measuring the progress of students and staff and academic performance, engaging in that strategic planning, as we noted, and approving the school calendar, things like that. School leader focusing more on the trenches and what's going on with the actual schools. Hire and evaluate school staff, oversee the finances, making sure that all expenses, et cetera, daily are aligned with the budget, ensuring compliance with applicable state laws, taking responsible steps to make sure you have maximum attendance, identifying future staffing needs, working on performance reports, LCAPs, you know, SARCs, other things like that that are going to be produced publicly and to the board members. And then a lot of the general administrivia, you know, managing student records, teacher records, other legal compliance, et cetera. As you can see, there's no bright line down the middle here, but there's a pretty clear distinction between governing and managing. And as you'll see on this slide, one of the ways that you distinguish between that, I'll look at the third bullet point first, is the board focuses on how well the organization is functioning and meeting its goals and long-term objectives. The administration focuses on how will we achieve the board and the charter's long-term goals and objectives. So how well versus how will. The other way to distinguish it and to think about it is like a professional sports team, a team ownership versus coach. And I think of Ted Lasso. If anybody's watched Ted Lasso and you know Rebecca was the owner of the football team, soccer team, and she hired Ted Lasso. And good governance and effective board governance understands that, you know, it's the team owner or Rebecca is not the one who calls the plays. They're the ones who hires the coach. The coach is the one who calls the plays, who trains the players, hires the players, and does all that. Again, the how will part of it. The team owner is the one who says, look, our goal is to win the championship or the Premier League, or in her case, to destroy her former husband's team, if any of you watched the show. But that's the distinction between the roles and responsibilities between the board and management. Board, again, establishes goals and policies for the organization, doesn't manage the day-to-day management of the organization, leaves those decisions on how to meet those goals to the administration, doesn't direct individual employees, and doesn't respond to individual complaints, as I said earlier. Now, again, I've been with your organization for a long, long time. I know you don't, this board and the Altus Schools Southern California board is extremely high functioning board and understands these roles and relationships, but you'd be surprised how many charter schools, especially one-off single schools where we've got a conversion high school or something like that, and some of the parents are on the board or teachers are on the board. It's very hard in some of those organizations to keep this distinction because they're meeting at the school site. They know the other teachers, they know the other parents, and a lot of the times the board gets involved in the management and tries to manage the school, and that's where things can go off the rails for charter schools. One of the things to keep in mind is that you have a legal and an obligation here that ties to your any potential liability as board members to maintain your fiduciary duty to the organization. Any corporation you're part of, you've heard this, the fiduciary duty is an obligation to act in the best interest of another party. Here, as a board member for a nonprofit public benefit corporation, your actions, your interest, your attendance, your loyalty has to be directed to serving the needs of the corporation, which serves the schools, the parents, the communities, et cetera. And fiduciary duties can be broken down into primary three areas: fiduciary duty of care, duty of inquiry, and duty of loyalty. Duty of care, which is stated in the corporation's code, not the clearest fashion, but it means acting in good faith and in an interest, you believe to be in the best interest of the corporation and with such care as an ordinary prudent person would do under like circumstances. And that's the legal standard of the reasonable person standard. And the reasonable person standard is just that it's you're acting with, you know, the care, skill, and prudence and diligence that's necessary for that particular item that you're looking at, which means if you are operating and studying a complex contract or a complex budget matter, and you're new to charter schools and public school finance, it means understanding the circumstances, asking questions. You have the right and practically the legal obligation to familiarize yourself with that in a way you can ask for experts, you can ask the staff to provide clarification. And when measuring whether or not a board member has met this duty of care, you know, courts and the like would look to see your own background and experience. If you did or did not have any background experience in these areas where mistakes are made. So the duty of care, just to go a little deeper in it, means stay informed, you know, be informed and be proactive in your role. Ask questions and clarity before voting. Listen to all perspectives and test your understanding. You know, own your decision. Make sure you can say, yes, I've taken this position because I researched it, I understand it, and this is the best position for the corporation. And again, staying out of the day-to-day business operations of the school is always you maintain your duty of care to the organization. Examples, you know, again, you got a contract that's in front of you. That's, do you understand it? Do you understand the legal provisions? Do you understand the risk sharing? Is it reasonably priced? Did the school go out and compare prices? Understanding the charter school's financial documents, which can be extremely difficult. Public school finance, I'm in obviously the private world, but I also work with public charter schools in State California. Public school finance is extremely convoluted. And there are very few rare people, Marion, Lynn, Tim, and others, who fully, truly understand and appreciate the complexities of public school finance. And where some of our clients over the years have not appreciated that and mistakes have been made, schools unfortunately have closed. Duty of care means monitoring the charter school's progress towards its goals and asking questions of staff on complex matters. Part of the duty of care is this duty of inquiry. It means asking the questions when you don't understand, but it also means that if there's something that is a red flag or something that catches your attention, it means the legal obligation to speak up and ask questions to make sure that you fully understand. It's that reasonable person standard. Would a reasonable person facing these circumstances go deeper, ask the following follow-up question? Duty of loyalty means always acting in the manner that's in the best interest of the corporation and not your individual business, personal, political perspective. And so it's primarily associated with avoiding conflicts of interest, which you learned in the last session from Keila. The conflicts of interest involve statutory conflicts of interest, being financially interested in the contract, political reform act contracts, conflicts of interest where you're financially interested in action before the organization, be it as a director or corporate, financial gifts, real property, all those things. Common law conflicts of interest, where you know you might have a personal connection to the action. This happens a lot where you have a parent on a school board and their student or their son or daughter's teacher is involved in the decision. Those are all areas where conflicts can occur. And if you get involved, you breach your duty of loyalty to the organization, therefore breaching your fiduciary duty, which creates potential liability for board members. Duty of loyalty has the six rings that we just mentioned: conflicts of interest with your code and policy, Government Code 1090, Political Reform Act, Corporations Code, anti-self-dealing provisions, any regulations applicable to the organization, and common law. So you have to jump through all of those hoops to maintain your duty of loyalty. So you got to act free from bias, as the Political Reform Act said. In any case where you cannot, you should abstain and disclose and abstain from involvement in that decision in order to maintain your duty of loyalty. Corporations Code codifies that you have the right to rely. You maintain your duty of fiduciary duty to the organization, a duty of care, if you ask the right people, you ask the right questions, you have the right to rely on the officers, counsel, independent accountants, experts. And even there's a provision here that says you can rely upon other committees if it's made up of committee that merits your confidence that you're not on, et cetera. So you have the right to rely upon expert advice in order to also exercise your fiduciary duties. So the reason why all that's important, not only because breach of your fiduciary duties can and does some often expose the organization to a threat or a claim from the granting agency for revocation or on renewal, but it can also expose an individual board member to personal liability. And if you perform your duties in consistent with subdivisions A and B, which are duty of care, duty of loyalty, then you are protected as a volunteer board member from liability serving on a nonprofit public benefit corporation in the state of California. And as you know, you are operating a nonprofit public benefit corporation, and you are also responsible for maintaining the fiscal oversight of the organization. So maintaining the long-term fiscal viability of the organization, as we said in the beginning, highly effective boards keep their eye on that long-term goal prize. What are we trying to achieve by way of academic outcomes? Who are we trying to educate? What is our charter? The first three elements of the charter are the academic program, who we're going to educate, and how we're going to measure how we're educating those students. That's where the focus of a lot of discussion should be by the board. How well are we doing achieving those objectives outlined in our charter? Because those objectives line up with the ability of the schools to be able to be renewed. And as we said, the school's performance is managed by the CEO, and the board hires the CEO and evaluates his or her performance towards meeting those goals.
Oh, just going back to the section before this, just wanted to reiterate that our board members are all insured. We carry the director's insurance, so that's to cover any possible liability.
Yeah, I will say, and to that point, thank you, Mary, in 30 years, I have not seen a nonprofit charter school board member in the state of California working on a charter school personally liable for any debts and liabilities or organizations. Now, doesn't mean that sometimes schools don't get sued and board members don't get individually named, but as Mary mentioned, because you've got directors and officers and other general liability policies, they step in and they defend those board members. And most of the time, we're successful in getting the board individual members out of the case because they're suing the organization, not the individual board members. So this chart, although it's not 100% accurate, and I'll explain why here for your organization, sort of demonstrates the level of board involvement and the level of board oversight over decision-making. Here in your organization, the way you're structured, the board's decision-making, you hire the CEO, this line should probably drop off a little lower here, and the CEO then hires the other organization administrators, and then they're responsible for the CEO, and the other administrators are responsible for hiring other people and staff. And that's where the board's level of involvement drops off. So the line is correct. But that's the trade-off and the balance in board involvement and the management of the organization. As I stated earlier, just to emphasize, nonprofit law protects volunteer board members, and you have the DNO to further protect your board members. But again, just to stay within the fiduciary duties and to make sure all coverage is applicable throughout the whole time, obviously, you don't want to act outside the course and scope of your duties. You know, this doesn't happen in your organization. But again, we have situations where individual board members have gone down to the school site and demanded records of other students or demanded records of other employees, not only breaching their fiduciary duties, engaging and managing, but also exposing themselves to privacy rights violations. Obviously, monitoring conflicts of interest, which is critical, maintaining your Form 700s every year, and making sure they're up to date, and avoiding, obviously, any willful misconduct like violating the law, trying to hold a board meeting Saturday morning without posting it, knowing that you're violating the Brown Act, for example, would be not a good decision. Just to go a little deeper in the financial oversight, because that's so key, we've had so many schools, as I mentioned, unfortunately fail because of fiscal malfeasance and just frankly negligence. But generally, just to cover it, annual budget is that, you know, your blueprint, you know, setting your spending priorities and goals. The board monitors and adjusts that throughout the year. Board members, and I know you all do, you know, to understand budget, balance sheets, cash flow positions, et cetera, to understand how public school finance comes to the school, how the correlation between enrollment and ADA and public school finances, again, just having those high level understandings, reviewing the financial reports as they're presented to the organization and to the board, and understanding where the organization stands with its reserves and cash flow, et cetera. As we said, this is just critical because in cases where the board has held a really hands-off or laissez-faire relationship with this administration, if the administration didn't have the sophistication that your organization has, there's been fiscal mismanagement and the board has not caught that. It's key to adopt, and I know your organization does, fiscal control policies that sets guardrails around how the organization is managed, consistent with best practices, your auditor's recommendations, et cetera. You can be revoked, as I said earlier, for fiscal mismanagement, failing to meet generally acceptable accounting principles. Fiscal mismanagement is pretty broadly defined by your granting agencies. If you run below a minimum reserve, if you're declining enrollment and you have no mechanism for fixing that, if you're overspending, if your long-term projected expenses exceed your revenue in your multi-year fiscal projections, these are all areas where you can get hit with fiscal mismanagement, either non-renewed or threatened for revocation. Chartering authority has the right to assess and monitor your fiscal condition. So does the County Office of Education. They can ask for financial reports and frequently do to make sure they're also monitoring your fiscal condition. There's a provision in the law that essentially says that a granting agency is not liable for the debts and obligations of a charter school as long as it's effectively monitoring and overseeing the charter school, which includes the same financial oversight and responsibilities that the board members have. So there's a little duplication there as well as with the county. And you have your annual independent financial audits, which are required. So the audit that's required annually validates your reported finances, also used to validate the charter school's internal controls. They look at ADA, et cetera, that your auditors do. You typically approve your audit agreement for your auditor in the spring, and you're producing your audits in the fall for the prior year. Those are the main points that I wanted to go through on effective board governance and management practices for, again, I compliment this board, and that's not us as a vendor brown-nosing the board, but you've had stability on this board. You've had a long-term success operationally, fiscally, academically. And so I feel you are exercising a lot of these principles that we're already talking about here today. Mary, any thoughts on that piece of this two-part presentation?
No, thank you. I don't have anything.
Any of the board members have any thoughts, sir?
Council Minnie, this is that board member Crean. On slide 69, I do like you adding that bullet point on 8 where you talked about legal. I thought that was a good point that you may have just
had on. Adding legal, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a good one.
Thank you, board member Crean. All right, Kayla, let's see if this is a summary of some of the most critical laws and changes that we're facing and some of the court cases that we're working on. I'll jump in and out too, Kayla, but I'll turn it over to you and I'll go through the slides with you.
Okay, that's great. Good morning, everyone. Happy to be back. So the final stretch of our training today, it's new laws, critical case updates. Paul and I gave this training to you all last year. You all are very diligent about your training. And a lot has happened just in the past year, so we have a lot to fill you in on. The first is, of course, every year we have a budget trailer act. There's a few measures that are very impactful for charter schools this year in particular. The governor signed the budget trailer bill at the end of June, and then as part of that, there were several provisions, like I said, that were very specific to charter schools that charter schools are now beholden to. So we're going to go over a few of those today. Now, Paul, I can't actually see the slides here.
Yeah, I don't know what glitched here. Hold on 1 second. I saw that my screen flickered and then it went away. Let me go back to, are we back on the slides?
Yes.
There we go. So we can just go one next one. Yep. So we're going to start with the good news, charter term extensions. So as you may recall, during the 21-22 legislative session, all charter terms that were between January 1st, 2022 and June 30th, 2025 were extended by 2 years. So we already had a two-year extension. This legislative session, we had another extension. The terms were further extended by 1 year for those that were between January 1st, 2024 and June 30th, 2027. So we got another year extension. Here's what it means just in practical terms. This last row here, that's where you'll see that's where Adeo Charter School is. So they did not get an extension the first round because their renewal fell out of the dates, but now they do get an extension in the second round. So if we go to the very next slide, it'll outline all of the Altus schools and their current terms and, you know, what the first extension did to them. And then what we got under this second extension here. So you'll see, you know, it's greatly beneficial. You know, the charter renewal process requires a lot of administrivia and administrative effort and time and bureaucracy. And, you know, to the extent that we don't have to go through that process and can focus on kids and focus on what we're here for, this is definitely a win. I will say, though, you know, we want to caution schools that while the 1 year is great, time goes quickly. And the appeal process now, as we'll talk about in some detail today, is quite contentious, specifically at the higher levels. So it could be as long as like a 15-month process to actually get your renewal, if things were appealed. The bottom line there is just basically start over. On the topic of
just interject here. It wasn't particularly advantageous to us because, one, we were already prepared and ready. We could have submitted. And so we had done the work, and our staff had. And two, it didn't fit into our strategic plan because we had a timeline and we had to move it. And we thought that it was particularly a good time to move forward. And then it was moved a year, where things change a lot in a year. So where it might have been a relief for some charter schools, we weren't really particularly relieved. We really were ready to spring and get it done. Sure. Just FYI.
Yeah, no, that's good to know. It's interesting because the CDE, after the budget trailer bill came out and they did the extension, the CDE put out a memo effectively saying, so no renewals will be submitted during this time. And, you know, we have basically a year. And there's nothing in the law that actually supports that, not submitting the renewal early. That said, you know, you could face other bureaucracy.
As I recall, we did approach the CDE and ask if we could waive that and go ahead and submit. And they said no. So,
yeah. Yeah, there's nothing in the law that actually allows them to do that. But, you know, the fight might not be worth it, basically. We also got some other bad news on the appeal process. So as you may recall, in 2019, we got AB 1505. It weakened charter appeal laws. It expanded reasons the district could deny charters to include fiscal impact on the district. It also changed the state board's standard of review on appeal from de novo, which is basically just a clean slate, to abuse of discretion, a much higher standard than most differential. And it removed the state board's authority to actually grant a charter upon appeal. Instead, they had to reverse a denial and remand back to the local authorizer who had denied in the first place, which was, you know, a recipe for strife and strained relations. Frustratingly, this year, the legislator made this already high standard of abuse of discretion even more difficult. So previously, even after AB 1505 and the more stringent abuse of discretion standard, you could appeal if there was a showing that either the district or the county had abused their discretion. Now it's an and, it's not an or. So now the petitioner has to show that both the district and the county abused their discretion in order to appeal. They also added language that abuse of discretion is the most deferential standard of review. That's already true. You know, we knew that already. It's basically just kind of a signal that these appeals are going to be very hard fought and very, very rarely granted. So, I mean, with 2019 and beyond, you know, the bottom line is that we just can no longer count on the state board as a viable option to appeal a denial. Our focus has to be on that approval at the lower level. Let's go to the next one. A quick note on a lawsuit in this domain, and then I'll also touch on a new one that was just filed since we actually created these slides. So the first is the Napa Unified CSBA lawsuit against Mayakamas Charter School and the State Board of Education. So we talked briefly about this lawsuit last year. This is just an update. So as we discussed, during the last renewal cycle, three charter schools appealed to the State Board. The state board determined that one of those schools had met the standard and reversed the lower denials. So they approved the charter on appeal. The district, Napa Unified, and the California School Board Association then turn around and sued the state board for that approval. And on the eve of the court ruling, the trailer bill came out and it changed the standard to what we just discussed. It's even harder. Both the district and the county now have to abuse their discretion. Now, that higher standard should not apply to this case, since the reversal happened before that newly heightened standard. But the lower court ruled against the state board and the charter school, and so the case is now stayed pending an appeal. We also have a new case in LA Superior Court on behalf of a charter school operator that has six charter schools in LA, in Orange County. It's Vista versus State Board of Education. Like I said, this was just filed a couple weeks ago. It was after these slides came out. So there, the district had denied a new charter school for that charter school operator. They alleged that the school would substantially undermine the district's current services. The charter school had demonstrated that the impact to the district was going to be exceptionally small. It was something like 0.026% of the district's students. Still, the denial stood, and so the charter school appealed to the state board. The state board, unfortunately, affirmed the denial, so they did not get into the substantially undermine language and process. They really didn't dig in, and so the litigation seeks to compel the state board to set aside its denial and rehear the petition, and you know, really make a good faith effort and energy to dig in and see what the understand that the denials were unwarranted.
Is that the same one as the charter school that originated in San Diego and was denied a high school? Or is that another one?
These ones were in LA and Orange County. I don't know, Paul, if you know about that one. This charter school operator has six schools in LA and Orange County. I'm not sure if they started in San Diego. I didn't see that, but Paul, you can speak to it if you know.
Okay, well, there was another one that was rejected, I understand. At least that's what was in the media.
Okay, interesting, yeah. More bad news. As you know, there was already a non-classroom-based moratorium, so that means that no non-classroom-based schools can be put into place before January 1st, 2025. And now, in this legislative session, that a moratorium is further extended to January 1st, 2026. And as part of that, in addition, if we go to that next slide there, we also got codified in law a requirement that FICMAT, the Fiscal Crisis and Management Assistant Team, get together. They're actually already undergoing this, but this actually puts it into law, and study the process used to determine funding for non-classroom-based schools and make recommendations. And this part of the law actually just makes me mad because it says make recommendations. The bold part here is actually part of the statute itself, to enhance oversight and reduce fraud, waste, and abuse. You know, that's biased language. It presumes that fraud, waste, and abuse are actually happening. And, you know, so seeing stuff like that is just incredibly frustrating. But even though they decided to put this into the law, this study was already underway. You know, we're expecting to see it sometime this spring, although things can slowly, you know, that's kind of the timeline that they've given us. So this is just, it's a report to watch and, you know, some incredibly frustrating antagonism towards non-classroom-based schools.
I should share with the board that the senior leaders were a part of that study, and we actually met with Matt, and it actually was a very pleasant meeting. It was very apparent that they were looking at differentiated funding depending on the design of the non-classroom-based school. And that was one of the questions that they asked, how would we differentiate the funding? My response was, we wouldn't differentiate it at all, that it would be based on student learning. And in fact, if students are learning, the mode of delivery is entirely up to what the parents feel is appropriate. So it, and I did dialogue with one of the FICMAT person after, and they were very complimentary of our school and what they were able to understand about our school during our interview. Not that that would necessarily change the direction of all this legislation, but it seemed to us very apparent that there would be some recommendation for differentiated funding based on schools, whatever the criteria is. We assumed it would have something to do with actual physical facilities. We volunteered to send all our leases that they could review, which of course they did not want because that would be huge. And again, it wasn't directed at us. We were simply a recommended school by one of the associations to be interviewed. So I'm glad we could be a part of it, but I don't anticipate that the recommendations coming down will be tremendously favorable to non-classroom-based schools.
I am glad to hear, though, that you all were part of it. You know, you all are such a successful non-classroom-based school that it is good to hear that, you know, that they weren't just seeking out, you know, what they assumed was this presupposed position about, you know, kind of the fraud and waste things that you all absolutely do not have. So I am happy to hear that they talked with you, Mary. Okay, money matters. More antagonism from non-classroom-based schools. For non-classroom-based schools. This session, we got a new add-on component to LCFF. It's an LCFF equity multiplier. It basically gives additional funding for schools with socioeconomic disadvantaged populations of more than 70%, but it specifically excluded non-classroom-based schools from eligibility for this additional funding. Next, we also have pending independent study regulations. So we already have regulations, basically revisions to them. It's going through the rulemaking process. So the comment period was open until August 1st. There were some issues that we've seen with the draft regulations that was before the comment period, but it suggests the minimum length of time for live interaction. That's nowhere in the statute. It appears to make traditional and course-based independent study interchangeable. They're not. And then it also suggests that LEAs must maximize a student's learning and mastery without a necessarily adequate definition of what that is and what that looks like and how that's assessed at the end of the day. So, you know, we'll see. It's another thing to look out for that, you know, we expect is coming sometime in 2024.
One last word in regard to that. I'm sure that the board considers the fact that it's ironical that there be such an effort to shackle a non-classroom approach, because the classroom takes many shapes and will take many shapes in the future. So what is potentially a futuristic approach to education, and certainly want to maintain standards, that we don't argue with that at all, but it's an avenue that is being pursued at all levels, certainly post-secondary levels. And it's the quality that we're looking at, that we should be looking at, and not necessarily the mode of delivery. But it's futuristic, and they're fighting it. And isn't that typical? That's so typical.
All right, we're going to delve into a pretty lengthy discussion of the First Amendment. As you know, that protects freedom of religion, the free exercise of that religion, and free speech. Disputes over religious expression in schools are nothing new. They've been a constant for years, but in the last couple of years, we've seen the Supreme Court weigh in. So the first case that we're going to talk about is this Kennedy versus Bremerton case. This was a big case. It made national news. Essentially, what was happening here is there was a high school football coach at a school district in Washington State. And the coach had a routine of after every game, he would go to midfield and say a prayer. The school district officials asked him to either stop the prayers or conduct them in a less conspicuous place. Like I said, he was doing them on the football field. He refused and they effectively fired him. He sued. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that these post-game prayers were protected by the First Amendment free speech and free exercise of religion clauses, and that thus the school district's firing was a violation of the First Amendment. The court, it was an interesting ruling. They determined that the practice of kneeling in prayer was private speech. It was something that the coach was just doing on his own as an individual, not government speech. So his actions couldn't be imputed to the school district itself. And so the school district went too far when it effectively fired him. And the court made a distinction between a case like this and cases where the Supreme Court has found that prayer between teachers and students is problematically coercive. Because here, unlike there, the prayers for which the coach was disciplined, they weren't recited to a captive audience. There wasn't any requirement that students participate in those prayers, although I will say that some did. But so they drew a distinction there between activities involving students or engaging students and those where it was just the employee, him or herself. And go over to the next slide. So in circumstances like this, according to our Supreme Court, the Constitution neither requires nor permits school districts to suppress religious expression by its employees. It's likely to have practical consequences for schools and their supervision of teachers and other employees, but it does leave a lot of questions unresolved. It doesn't, for instance, answer the question of what it'll mean for students, like, will students have greater protection for their own religious expression in schools if they aren't praying with others, et cetera. So we expect that is something that we will see play out in the next few years. But it was an interesting case. And like I said, we're going to talk about several of them today. We had a lot of First Amendment cases over the last couple of years. All right, next up is Carson v. Macon. And this is another case, another Supreme Court case. This case involved the state of Maine. Maine has this special state tuition program where they provide funding for families in towns without public high school. So really rural area that doesn't have a public high school. There can be a private high school and the state will actually fund that school with the caveat that this funding cannot be used to attend a religious school. The court found that this exclusion of religious schools from that state tuition program violated the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And, the decision has clear impact for states, of course, like Maine that have this program, but there are many others actually that have them as well. Vermont, New Hampshire, they've similarly excluded religious schools from this sort of distinctive tuition aid program. But from my perspective, the most important point from this case actually came from the dissent, those who did not agree with the ruling. The dissent expressed fears that this case could be brought in to lead to state aid for religious themed charter schools, something that we have also seen play out in the state in the last couple of years, or in the course of the last couple of years. So after this case came down in December of 2022, so we're coming up on a year, the then Oklahoma AG Attorney General drew nationwide notice when he concluded that the provisions of Oklahoma law that actually required charter schools to be non-sectarian, like we have here in California, and not affiliated with religious institutions would likely be struck down by the Supreme Court in light of this decision. And then if we go to the next slide to test that, In June, so we have this new case, just came out this year. In June, a Catholic organization submitted a charter application for a virtual Catholic charter high school in Oklahoma. The application was accepted. And as expected, the organization was sued. So the Oklahoma School Board did approve that application. It was going to be administered by the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City and the Diocese of Tulsa, scheduled to open less than a year from now. The vote passed 3-2. It had previously been denied, but the decision ultimately was to expand religious liberty. That's why the noted way that the approval came down was that they wanted to expand this religious liberty. Unsurprisingly, as I said, they got sued. If we can go to the next slide, we can see. There we go. It was the first lawsuit filed against the virtual charter, against the board who actually had approved this charter school. It was the first because this was the first religious charter school. And the plaintiffs claim that a publicly funded religious education violates the Oklahoma Constitution, which, as I said, requires that the charter schools be non-sectarian, and the Charter Schools Act, which, again, like California, requires the same. They cannot be religious schools. So defendants, if we go to the next one. So this is specifically just what the plaintiffs are seeking. So they don't want the church to operate as a charter school. They do not want the charter school board to be able to enter into contracts with the church. And they do not want the state to fund the church and thus fund this school. The defendant, in turn, is asserting exclusion of religious schools exclusively on the basis of religion. It's a violation of law. It's unconstitutional under the First Amendment Freedom of Religion Clause. They claim that charter schools are not public schools and therefore not state actors or acting with government authority, something we are also going to talk about in a minute. So stay tuned for the course determination. It's an interesting area of law. It's really cutting edge stuff is happening, and stuff like this is what keeps the work vibrant and interesting.
Massive political ramifications for charter schools nationwide, obviously, yeah. Depending on which way the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately goes on these cases.
We have another one. So this one is another interesting one here in California. So here, two non-classroom-based charter schools, along with the superintendent of public instruction and two school districts, were very recently sued, just last month, by parents who were claiming that the schools unlawfully denied them use of state funds to purchase religious materials for their homeschooling programs. And they cited the Carson v. Bacon case. They're asserting that when the government provides a benefit, like parent-directed educational funding at these non-classroom-based schools, it cannot exclude these families just because they choose to use that benefit for religious education. So effectively, the parents, as part of their educational dollars that they were given by the school, wanted to be able to purchase religious curriculum when the school said that they could not because they have a requirement under law to be non-sectarian. The parents sued, alleging that it was a violation of freedom of religion. This is just what I said. California law specifically prohibits the charter school from providing religious or faith-based criteria. There's various provisions here besides the Constitution and the actual Charter Schools Act. The CDE has also echoed these sentiments. We have never had an opinion that a public school's refusal to adopt a religious or faith-based curriculum would be a violation of freedom of religion or the First Amendment. This is one to watch. We can likely expect much press. YMC is representing one of the non-classroom-based defendants.
We did have a charter school, non-classroom-based charter school years ago, who was revoked for failure to continue to monitor its curriculum being purchased by parents and that it was religious material. And, it was revoked on that very ground that they were essentially funding a religious education.
Okay, now back to the freedom of speech. So this one also just came out last year. It was after our last training for you all last year. So it's relatively new. Here, there were school board members using Facebook and Twitter. They were publicly sharing information about board meetings, the open positions at the school and the administration, various student activities. They also posted and moderated comments that were on the school's public page. Two parents were making comments. They were vocal critics of the board. And they would just post dozens of repetitive comments to the board member's social media account over mere minutes. I mean, it was really harassing. And the board members deleted and hid the repetitive comments because it was, like I said, I mean, it was harassing. Eventually, both board members blocked the parents from their personal social media accounts. Again, these were their personal accounts. So that meant that the parents could no longer see or comment on the board members' posts. The board later introduced word filters, something that you can do under social media, where you can specifically block a comment if it has a, you can say whatever word you want it to. It can specifically block any comments being posted with that word. So this effectively prevented any person from commenting because the filters were pretty broad. The parents sued for First Amendment violation. And the plaintiffs are arguing that the school board members engaged in state action when they blocked individuals on even their personal social media accounts, that they were acting in their official capacity as board members because the board members were also managing the school's account. The defendants in turn argued that managing their personal social media accounts was not an official duty. They asserted that the use of the social media accounts was primarily just to further their own political careers. They tried to draw on a distinction between what they were doing in their personal accounts and the managing of their school accounts. As we'll see on the next slide, yeah. The Ninth Circuit, interestingly, decided the nexus between the board members' use of their social media pages and their official positions was close enough to actually qualify them as acting under color of the state law. So the court found that blocking the comments was unconstitutional. Not surprisingly, this was appealed to the Supreme Court. They just heard arguments a couple weeks ago. And so we'll see a decision likely in 2024. But it came out of the Ninth Circuit, and it was just a reminder that, you know, what we do as board members, even our personal capacity, can be imputed to the school and the official position.
Well, as we saw, what, 3 or 4 years ago, too, under the Public Records Act, individual board members' use of their personal email accounts and text messages for school business was now subject to Public Records Act requests. So it's that expansion of the new technologies in that area of school business.
Finally, to round out our First Amendment cases, we have Chen versus Albany. Another Ninth Circuit decision came down last year. So in this case, the Ninth Circuit upheld a California school district's discipline of two high school students. These students had an Instagram account. They were using that account off campus. But they were filling that account with racist imagery and comments targeting their Black classmates. The school disciplined them, and in turn, the students sued, alleging that the off-campus speech was protected by the First Amendment and not subject to school discipline. The court unanimously rejected the students' arguments and held that the school district was absolutely within its right to discipline, and doing so did not violate any First Amendment freedoms. So it offers an interesting juxtaposition to a case that we actually talked with you all about last year, the Mahanoy versus BL case, which also addressed school discipline of off-campus speech, but it came to the opposite results. So as you may recall, in Mahanoy, the school disciplined a student for her campus social media rant about her cheerleading. The Supreme Court determined that the discipline violated her First Amendment rights. However, that case did leave open the possibility of school discipline for off-campus speech for circumstances like here, where students were bullying on social media, something that we've just seen a lot in kind of the litigation side of things, and threatening to harm the rights of others. So it's an interesting juxtaposition of, whereas in Mahanoy, the cheerleader who, well, she didn't make the cheer team and was very upset about it and was spewing profanities about the school, she wasn't actually hurting anyone. She wasn't targeting anyone else. Whereas here, you know, this was a very clear indication of bullying and, like I said, racist imagery and racist comments. And so the Ninth Circuit drew that distinction there. All right. Charter schools as state actors, are they, aren't they? The decision here came down from the Fourth Circuit and test whether a charter school is a state actor for purposes of student claims. And that determination is, of course, incredibly important. If a charter school is a state actor, they can be sued for violations of constitutional rights. This is because the 14th Amendment states that states cannot deny persons equal protection of laws. That's the Equal Protection Clause. So it begs the question, who is the state? You know, what does it mean by the state? And what actors can be considered as acting on behalf of the state and thus subject to the dictates of the 14th Amendment? So this case, if we go to the next slide, it involved a charter school in North Carolina. The school had this requirement that girls wear skirts to school. And the mother of a female kindergarten student objected to that requirement, saying, you know, my daughter's five. She wants to be able to run, play, jump, and having to wear a skirt is harming her ability to do so. To her objection, unfortunately, the school explained that they emphasize traditional values and enforces a code of conduct where girls are treated as if they are, quote, a fragile vessel men are supposed to honor and take care of. In an effort to, again, quote, preserve chivalry and respect among young women and men in the school of choice. The girls' parents and others brought an action against the school, arguing that sex-based classification grounded on gender stereotypes violates the Equal Protection Clause. The Fourth Circuit issued a 101-page opinion, included lively exchanges among the various justices. Ultimately, the majority found the charter schools are state actors. So despite the 101 pages of debate, it said that the state action inquiry is actually non-complicated. One, North Carolina is required under its constitution to provide free K-12 schooling to its residents. Two, North Carolina has fulfilled this duty in part by creating and funding the public charter school system. And three, North Carolina has exercised its sovereign prerogative to treat these state-created and state-funded schools as public institutions, And that, so all of that amounts to them being state actors. However, the inquiry, if we go to the next slide, is, you know, they said that it wasn't complicated despite the 101 pages. It is quite complicated, and it's seemingly inconsistent with Ninth Circuit authority that has held that charter school operators are not state actors. You know, given the circuit split.
Just to be clear though, is charter schools operating as nonprofit public benefit corporations or whether or not they're state actors? That's the, it's that mix, it's that hybrid between the public and private that's creating the main confusion here. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
But like I said, you know, we've had these Ninth Circuits say that those same are and then are not, and then we've had the Fourth Circuit now say that they are. Given the circuit split, and actually the Attorney General specifically asked the current administration to weigh in on this, we expected that this case might actually be heard by the Supreme Court, but they declined to hear the case. So that Fourth Circuit appellate court ruling that charter school is a state actor is precedent. But again, like I said, we have the Ninth Circuit that is not. So, you know, it's kind of the appeal, the decision stands. And given that the Supreme Court declined, we still kind of have an open question in the country overall over whether charter schools are or are not state actors.
And I will say that the National Charter Schools Association adamantly opposed the idea that charter schools are not state actors. They want charter schools to remain state actors, whether or not they operate as nonprofit benefit corporations, because they believe that if the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately concludes that nonprofit operators of charter schools are not state actors, North Carolina's law was not a lot different in many ways than California's law, that we will see the spread of religious-based charter schools like we started on the early First Amendment slides, and that we will see the political tides of the left-leaning states, California included, possibly put a moratorium on all, you know, future charter schools, or even withdraw the charter school movement completely from the state, which the legislature has the authority to do. So they see this as a hugely existential threat to Charter Schools Act and charter school survivability, that charter schools remain state actors. I'm not quite sure it's that clear. We've already, like Kayla said, we've already had a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision conclude that Arizona Charter School was operating as a nonprofit, was not a state actor, and therefore could not be sued for civil rights violations. And it hasn't obviously led to the closure of charter schools there or here, which the Ninth Circuit, by the way, covers California as well. And we've had district court decisions dismiss civil rights lawsuits against charter schools under that same case law. So I guess a lot of this is very academic and very mostly interesting to the lawyers. But it does affect this next discussion as well.
Absolutely. So here we just a quick note about a law, an important lawsuit against CalSTRS right now. So in this lawsuit, we have found that some nonprofit corporations operating multiple charter schools had individual employees or retirees be informed that because that employee or retiree worked at the nonprofit corporation or the home office level, which is kind of an inartful term, to them just not being exclusively assigned to one school, that because of that, they did not work for an employer for purposes of the education code, and therefore did not perform a creditable service, and therefore should not have been in CalSTRS. A lawsuit has been filed in this, and I, you know, Paul might have some.
This is the Green Dot versus California State Retirement System, the case that we talked about last time.
All right, labor and employment.
I don't recall you talking about it last time.
I think Paul said that you all had talked about not in our big training last year, but in a previous board meeting.
Yeah, it's the Green Dot versus Green Dot and Kelly Hurley versus the California State Retirement System that's challenging the state, the CalSTRS position.
I know what it is.
Okay.
You said that
we
discussed it like at the last training, which we did not.
Not last training. Yeah, my mistake. I apologize. Mm-hmm.
So as Paul said, there were at the beginning, we're going over just kind of a high level, some of the new laws that were, and interspersing them with critical case laws that we want you all to know about. There were many, many new laws this legislative session in 2024 that will be in effect in 2024, a couple actually that are already in effect because they were urgency legislation that came into effect that impact charter schools, that make additional requirements for charter schools. There were like over 100 of them. We're going over just a very few today. Because it is, it's a whole new world out there where, you know, the mega waiver is being kicked away and, you know, there's just more and more requirements. But to that end, we're going to talk about a few in the employee context. So we'll start with SB 497. This one creates a rebuttable presumption in favor of an employee who's making a discrimination or retaliation claim. If an employee makes that claim and then an employer engages in discriminatory or retaliatory action within 90 days of the specified protected activity that they're claiming on, this creates a rebuttable presumption in favor of the employee. So it's very employee driven. The penalty is an employer that is a corporation or LLC is subject to a civil penalty of up to $10,000 per employee for each violation. So it broadens protected conduct and is very employee friendly. We also had SB 700, cannabis discrimination. So it makes it unlawful for an employer to request information from an applicant relating to the applicant's prior use of cannabis. But information about a person's prior use obtained from the person's criminal history is exempt from this provision. if the employer is permitted to consider or inquire about that information under specified provisions of FEHA or other state or federal law. And then we also have SB 616, paid sick leave. This is just another requirement in the law that employers now have to provide employees with at least 5 sick days or 5 days or 40 hours of sick leave per year under specified conditions. But a note here that the Alta schools already far exceeds this requirement. So no need to worry about that one. We also got SB 848, leave for reproductive loss. So it makes it unlawful for an employer to refuse to grant a request for eligible leave to take up to 5 days following reproductive loss. It requires the leave to be taken within 3 months. And if the employee experiences more than one qualifying event within a 12-month period, i.e. more than one loss, the employer is not obligated to grant more than 20 days within that year period. And also importantly, the leave may be unpaid. So you have to grant the leave, but it may be unpaid. Okay, PAGA claim arbitration, Viking River Cruises. This case tested whether PAGA claims are subject to individual arbitration in California. So here, a former employee filed a PAGA action against her employer in California state court. She sought civil penalties, and she claimed that her employer had failed to provide her with final wages within the time frame required under the labor code. She also asserted many, many other labor code violations, minimum wage, overtime, meal periods, rest periods, time of pay statements that were allegedly sustained by actually other employees of the company. Viking moved to compel arbitration of the former employee's individual PAGA claim, as we'll see in the next slide. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed the California Supreme Court. They held that the former rule that an individual PAGA claim is not divisible from their representative PAGA claim, that her broader claim about all of the other employees who had suffered wage and hour violation, is incompatible with the Federal Arbitration Act. So what it means is that employees need to evaluate their arbitration agreements going forward and work with counsel, craft the agreements to include within their scope individual PAGA claims as well as provisions to prevent agreements from being interpreted as wholesale waivers of the representative PAGA claims, you know, meaning that just one employee can bring many, many claims on behalf of several employees. And to maneuver, you know, just this minefield of other provisions that could prevent the enforcement of arbitration agreements between employees and their employers. It's a complicated inquiry, and you know, so we always recommend in those cases to seek the advice of counsel. Student matters. All right. Student conduct. This is actually a trend that we've seen last year. After I gave this comprehensive training, Jerry Simmons and I did a new law training in July, and we saw a statute that was very similar to this. It's about, and now this just makes it even further. So this effectively says that schools cannot suspend students for willful defiance. Schools, including charter schools, with high school students cannot suspend the students for willful defiance, something that was previously allowed under the act. But importantly, it does retain a teacher's authority to suspend any student from their class. So what that would mean is though the student cannot be suspended like an out-of-school suspension, a teacher could suspend a student and just have them, you know, basically be an in-campus suspension for this willful defiance. Next step. We also have student excused absences. This was actually something as well that we saw in the last legislative session in addition to this legislative session. So the first one, SB 350, it increases the number of days a student must be excused to attend a funeral. The current law is 1 day for an in-state funeral and 3 days for an out-of-state funeral. This just extends it to 5 days. And it requires that the student be excused for not more than 3 days for the purposes of grief support services as well. We also saw a revision to religious retreats. Current law requires that students be excused for 4 hours of religious retreats per semester, so like basically a half school day. This extends it out to a full school day, so they have to be excluded for, they have to be given at least a full school day. Curriculum. Okay, we are rounding out our discussion here. The last one that we are going to talk about is diversity in curriculum, something, again, that we have seen increasingly over the last couple of years. So this new law, AB 1078, it is an urgency statute. That means that it takes place immediately. So it was enacted into law in September 25th of this year, and it took place right away. It took effect right away. So what it does is it requires schools, including charters, when adopting instructional materials, to include materials that consider the role and contributions of Latinx Americans, LGBTQ plus Americans, other ethnic, religious, cultural, socioeconomic status groups. So it doesn't necessarily require a change to current curriculum, but when adopting new curriculum, these things have to be considered and these contributions have to be part of that curriculum. We'll go to the next slide. I'll chat a little bit further about it. So we currently have in place the Safe Place to Learn Act, which requires the CDE as part of its just regular monitoring and review of schools to assess whether schools have policies that prohibit discrimination, harassment, and bullying. This requires that policy, that bullying, discrimination, harassment policy, to include a statement that it applies to all acts of the governing body or body of the school in enacting those policies and procedures. So not just the students or not just the staff, but the governing body as well. And then it also requires the CDE to no later than about a year and a half from now, July 1st, 2025, to additionally develop guidance and public educational materials that meet the requirements of the what I just talked about, the Latino community, the LGBTQ plus community, the varying things that are now going to be required for in future adoption of instructional materials. So it requires the CDE to develop guidance about those to give schools, you know, some idea of what is and what is not acceptable in the CDE's eyes. And with that, I think we are rounding it out. So happy to answer any questions from anyone.
I want to say as a lawyer, sorry that so many legal issues are playing out in public schools, legislatively and litigation and court cases. It's absolutely amazing right now, frustrating for so many of the clients, these issues with critical issues, retirement benefits and religious curriculum, state actors issues. And I mean, it's just the obviously the some of these issues are very politically charged as well.
Speaking for me as a board member, for myself as a board member, you know, Paul and Kayla really appreciate all the time and effort you guys put into giving such a thorough presentation. So just don't take the lack of questions as that's a sign of job well done. You know, you guys covered it all, and definitely some frustrating things going on out there, but we appreciate you putting this together for us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And just to assure the board, we are in constant dialogue with Young, Mini, and Core. We are very, very cautious about everything, just to be very sure that we are always compliant and always responsive to the board's inquiry. Thank you very much. The two of you were sensational. We appreciate that. I'm not sure, is Admiral on yet, or did he get? I know he's traveling. No, he didn't make it. He was delayed. Okay, then I guess I'll conclude this meeting. From time to time, the board has topics of interest they'd like to share with the community. These are informational in nature and do not require action. Are there any comments from the board? I would like to remind you that on December 7th at 8:30, we have our regular board meeting. And it's very important. We have some issues that really need quorum and we need your input on. So that's December 7th at 8:30 in the morning. Moving on, adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
Motion moved.
That was David. I have a second.
That was Crean.
Crean, second?
Second, Morton.
Okay. Then we'll conduct a vote. David Crean?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Okay, so meeting adjourned. Thank you very much to everyone for your patience and your understanding.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Have a great day.